From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 25th day of May, 2020. Happy Memorial Day. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll hear an excerpt from our Commodity Week program recorded last week. Just the conversation that I had with Bill Biederman from agmarket.net. I think you'll want to listen back to that and hear what he has to say about the commodity markets. And then we'll go back through a couple of stories I've produced over the decades that I really like, one of them about that grain elevator museum in Atlanta, Illinois, and the other one from Ypres, Belgium in Europe. That's where Flanders Field is, and the reason that we remember the servicemen who have given the last full measure of their life to the countries that they love. It's the reason red poppies are always around on Memorial Day.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The markets are closed, so there's no update of the numbers from the CME Group in Chicago. Now, last Thursday during Commodity Week, we had a really good conversation with Bill Biederman from agmarket.net, and I thought it might be worthwhile hearing that again today. I asked Bill up front what things he thought we should talk about.
Well, I think the market is really focused on demand and what's going on in Washington. So you got the demand, you got the ethanol coming back, people are starting to drive. You got China, who is, you know, really making some strong efforts to get some purchases on the books, but a lot of rhetoric, negative rhetoric coming out of Washington and firing back from China. It's got us on edge. There's just no doubt. I mean, if the trade deal falls apart, agriculture will be in trouble, no doubt. Then you got the funds that are massively short, never been this short this time of year. And you got statistically a lot of stats telling us that don't be selling it down here.
For the last 6 to 10 weeks, farmers really haven't made grain sales. Elevators have been servicing the limited demand, and it appears they can service the limited demand for another 6 weeks. What does this mean for cash prices to you?
Well, we're observing right now, and, you know, of course, it's a big country, and, you know, what we're observing is a very small speck of it. But, you know, we're seeing that most cash sales, if an elevator or an end user is needing corn right now, it's going about 7 cents above posted bid. So I think that, you know, some areas might be a little bit shorter than others. I mean, I know further out into the cattle yards, it's definitely tighter. And I think that you're right. I mean, if we can get through the next 8 weeks without having a surprise threat or where the farmer holds tight, then you're going to probably see farmers letting go of stuff. But, you know, I mean, I think the next 8 weeks pretty much tells the tale on the seasonality. Here's some statistics. I mean, since 2006, these corn is traded above $4 all but one time. And in 19 out of 20 years, looking back, these corn has traded above the insurance price, with the exception of 2001. And on average, it'll trade 57 cents above insurance price. But, you know, even just to get back to insurance this year, we got to move 50 cents. So, you know, statistically, this is a really good time to not be selling. And I think most farmers know that. And they're going to hold on for a while, see what happens. And maybe they'll get a little bridge money from the government to help them. But 8 weeks from now, if we're not seeing higher prices, I think there's going to be a little bit of fear going through the countryside.
You listed up front that the funds were massively short at this time of year. How much pause does that give you?
Well, I mean, it scares me to be heavily short at this price. I think anybody who's looking at where, especially if you have a high insurance rate, you got to be looking at some cheap calls here to protect the upside. If these funds happen to come out of their short position and get long, it equates to about a 48 cent price rise just on their volume alone. So, you know, you would, and I don't know what it's going to take to get the funds to go long. I don't know if it means we need to see more exports. I don't know if it means we need to see consumer confidence and we see some indications of inflation with stimulus. But, you know, they've never really stayed short an entire year. So it's hard to imagine that they will. But, you know, if they start buying, it would be very, it could be exciting. It could be short-lived, but it would definitely give us a boost.
And so you're suggesting that producers find a way to protect that upside potential by using calls?
Most of our customers have come in here just recently, spent less than 12 cents on calls, spent less than 6 cents, all the way down to just a couple of cents on some kind of a call spread to protect some of the upside potential of this market. So for two reasons. One, the real high, the 90% guys, it does protect their insurance potential. But for most guys, it's just a courage call. They'll be able to sell a 20-cent bounce, and if they can sell the board or a cash market 20 cents higher than where they're at right now, they'd actually be in a completely paid-for neutral position if it goes up. And if it goes down, they'd have those sales made. So we're just trying to get people in a position to manage money. That's really the bottom line, because we're just as nervous as everybody else. If this thing, you know, if we end up having this massive crop and we don't cut acres and we get a record yield or whatever this, you know, the China deal falls apart, we will be in trouble from a financial standpoint. This agricultural sector will be in trouble.
So from your perspective, you're saying this price minus 12 cents is what I want to do as a bottom, and if it comes up, then I'm good to go.
Well, we're, yeah. I mean, like, each customer is different, right? So we spend different amounts. But,
right.
Yeah, bottom line is we're protecting the upside. That locks in insurance for the big guys, and for the other guys, it just gives us something to sell against. And once we, you know, if we don't get a 20-cent rally, we'll be selling anyway, just like everybody else. 8 weeks from now, if this market's not higher, everybody's going to be selling. It's going to be pretty hard decisions.
Has the president made a decision, do you think, that taking China on for coronavirus is a winning political strategy for November, and will the soybean market be cast aside because of that?
Oh, I don't think it's possible to know what he's going to do next, because, you know, one minute, I mean, he's thrown a lot of things out there. I mean, the chips to Huawei, and they responded with Apple, and you know, China's not going to be there. All their companies will be delisted off of our exchanges. We made this torpedo sale to Taiwan. We're recognizing the Taiwan president as president. You know, this is violating a lot of trust things that have been built since 1979. And yet, at the same time, I mean, okay, we do know that China's taken over the shipping industry. You know, we agree with a lot of things, but the question is this the right time to be doing this? I mean, we need this economy to turn around. This economy is so fragile that our president of the Federal Reserve Bank, Powell, basically said we're to the point where worrying about the debt doesn't matter. That was a quote. And then he said, you know, we need to provide liquidity at whatever cost. That's like telling my wife, I've got this margin call that's so huge that I've got to meet it no matter what the cost is, and then we'll be okay. Don't worry. And, you know, that's a scary thing to say, because we're at the point where either the entire world who's funding this COVID shutdown, that all that money either causes the economy to take off and recover, or if it fails, you're looking at just the worst worldwide depression ever. So, I mean, that's why he's saying it. We don't have a choice. We got to meet the margin call. But then on the other hand, if you've got a president who's cutting down relationships with trade partners, it's going to make that recovery that much harder. It's a very complex situation.
Any final word, Bill?
I think the first thing you got to do is you got to recognize what the potential is based on the macros. We're seeing a lot of commodities moving higher. Just take a look at OJ. Hey, oats. Oats traded higher than the price of corn today. How about that? So take a look at the big macro picture and realize that there could be something that happens based on all of the funding that's going on around the world that could turn inflationary, and that would be very bullish to commodities. On the other hand, if the economy fails or if we don't see a demand destruction further, this agricultural sector is in trouble. So here's what I would suggest. Number one, set up a strategy so that you're protecting your equity that you have on the farm with on a micro basis, looking at what's happening with your markets, making sure you've got upside protection, but you're making sales to where you'll stay in business the next year. On the other hand, look at the big macro picture and make sure that if something does kick in, like OJ, cocoa, sugar, all these energy, these markets are moving higher, and they're doing it in such a quiet way that nobody even recognizes it. If that happened to you in your corn market after you made a sale, you'd be sick. So you got to position yourself for the macro.
That's Bill Biederman from AgMarket.net, recorded last Thursday. Bill was a panelist on our Commodity Week program, along with Garrett Toy and Aaron Curtis. You can hear the whole of that program up on our website right now if you'd like at willag.org, willag.org. It's Memorial Day. The markets are closed. Don't forget that you can always find our programming as a podcast as well in Stitcher, SoundCloud, NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Podcast, and even Spotify. Now up next, one of my favorite stories. You know, back in 1904, there was a grain elevator built in the town of Atlanta, Illinois. That one closed in the mid-70s, but in the early 90s, a few of the townsfolk there decided to save that aging building. Now it's on the Registry of Historical Places in the United States. We'll visit the J.H. Hawes Grain Elevator and Museum. Our story can be aired in perpetuity with the permission of those speaking.
I'm Paul A. Adams from Atlanta, Illinois. In about 1869, this east-west alignment of a railroad that extended from Terre Haute to Peoria was under construction, and the railroad promoters pointed out that why should these farmers around Atlanta be shipping their grain to Chicago and then transporting it back down to Peoria, Illinois to be processed at the mills and so forth. Well, this building is a little bit unique in that in the early 1900s was a transition of trying to handle grains more in a bulk medium instead of sacking it up in sacks and moving it around or handling it so much. This was a mechanization of the handling of grain. Farmers normally stored their ear corn along in January and February of the year when the corn had dried out some in the cribs. It was possible to shell the corn and deliver it to central elevators such as this for transshipment to Decatur, Chicago, Peoria, and places like that. I think that one of the things that we don't quite remember clearly is that not many people stored grain in elevators at that time like we do now, because the corn, in order to keep when it was harvested in the ear, was probably 20 to 22% moisture, and the only way we had to dry it out was to put it in ear corn cribs, and the air flowing through the ear corn cribs dried the grain down sufficiently to get down, say, to 15-16% moisture level, and at that level it was possible to bring grain in and hold it a little bit in storage. But primarily these elevators were a transfer point from the farm to the processor, which meant we brought it into an elevator, loaded it in a boxcar, and moved it on. This building appeared to be in rather sad shape, but the only parts of a sad shape, in my opinion, was the siding was well weathered and some of it was off, and the roof wasn't quite in good shape. But structurally inside, this is built to stand and stand. were going to pull it over, it probably just pulled over in one big piece.
Dean May was really interested, one of the first ones that really wanted to save this elevator. The town was going to burn it down for a fire project, training project, and a group of us got together and we decided to form an organization, and we did, and it's Atlanta Preservation Council, Atlanta Historical Preservation Council. We did save the elevator. The city gave us the elevator because it had come to them. And eventually we were able to get a grant, and it was a matching grant. And we went out, solicited the people, and they helped us. We got very little money from big organizations or anything. We got very, very little. We really appreciate what the people did, because I said that we couldn't start out other places if we couldn't get the people behind us. And they have been behind us. And then we we're able to get it on the National Historic Preservation, and we're very proud of that. And that didn't take very long. Our first checks were written in 1991, and by 99 we had rededicated this elevator. The engine came from the Eminence Grain and Coal Company, which is about 3.5-4 miles out of town, and it was restored by Dean May, and he put it back in really wonderful condition, and that's how it got here. Volunteer work has gone in. The bricks in the engine building were all cleaned by volunteers in the cold old days. And we've had a lot of people volunteer their help on laying bricks and carrying mortar and fixing windows, and we have tried to keep it as historically as possible.
Well, I guess we might say it's just we enjoy showing people how it used to be done. I can't say primitive way, but somewhere between primitive and modern day, it was done through houses like this. Well, they stopped on the scale platform with the load originally, and then after they weighed and cleared the scale house, they'd drive on up in here and stop on the dump logs, and they'd trip it and run the load down in the pit, end of the leg, up in the bend.
The scales came from out in the country, and I was just riding my bike in the morning downtown, and there were four people walking around, and I had a feeling they had been from here, and I stopped and visited with them. To make a long story short, we came over in the afternoon, and the scales in the scale house was from a farm out in the country, and they didn't know their dad very well because their parents had divorced. And when they looked down in the scales, there was their dad's name with grain that he had brought to that farmer, and he kept all the list of grain and the weights. And I soon saw tears in their eyes. The city hall and the library, when they're open, you can always get someone there to call one of us who have a key to open it and show you around. It's always open during June, July, and August on Sunday afternoons from 1 to 3. But if anybody comes through, most people in town know who to call and get the elevator open. And I ride my bike around a lot, and I've gone home and gotten the key many a time, brought people down here, and I've had a wonderful time showing the elevator.
One last story for the day, this one about Flanders Field, red poppies, and Ypres, Belgium.
The village of Ypres was destroyed in the Great War, but Belgium was freed from Germany. From 1914 to 1918, more than 250,000 servicemen of the then British Empire lost their lives. Many of these brave soldiers, not only from Great Britain, but also from Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and many other lands, lie buried in the 154 war cemeteries which surround modern-day Ypres. A further 100,000 still have no known grave. Of these, 54,896 are commemorated by name on the Menin Gate along the city wall of Ypres. Every evening since 1928, the last post has been sounded beneath the great concrete arches of the Menin Gate. This tribute is played in honor of the men who fought and died at Ypres during the First World War.
These men have been chosen because their lives and deaths can tell us something about a terrible conflict in which they were involved. A conflict which shaped the course of the 20th century and which still has an influence on all our lives even today.
Ypres in Belgium is home to Flanders Fields, a place where for 4 years Allied forces fought back against the Germans. The trenches here, the entire battlefield was filled with mud. When it dried out, red poppies bloomed. We buy them every Memorial Day to honor the men who died for Belgium and the world. It is a way, a reason, to remember their stories.
These stories are stories of mud and blood, of unspeakable suffering and limitless human endurance. However, there are also stories of courage and devotion to duty, of comradeship and self-sacrifice. They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them.
At the come down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them. At the Menin Gate in Ypres, Belgium, for the last post ceremony, I'm Todd Gleason.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand anytime you'd like. Just click and play right out of our website at willag.org, willag.org. Or if you prefer, you can check us out as a podcast. This would be a great time to see if that Bluetooth radio in your truck or tractor or car works really well with your corn. Look us up in your favorite podcast applications, including Stitcher, SoundCloud, NPR One, Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Google Podcast.